News Now.
WMAL News at 7. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. A slow and grinding process in the Senate overnight as Democrats and Republicans clashed on a $1.9 trillion coronavirus-related spending package.
Debate and votes on the American Rescue Plan stalled for nearly 12 hours as Democratic leaders in the Senate hammered out a deal with West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin on unemployment benefits. The deal would add $300 a week to unemployment insurance through September 6th, making much of that untaxable for most Americans. The breakthrough likely gives Democrats the support they need to approve a final COVID relief bill later this morning without any Republican votes. Democrats in the House would need to take up the revised measure next week. Jared Halpern, Fox News.
The Maryland State House lit up last night for the COVID-19 Remembrance Vigil held on the one-year anniversary of the state's first COVID cases and the start of the state of emergency. Governor Larry Hogan reflected on the 7,748 Marylanders lost to the virus.
Many of whom couldn't even have their loved ones by their side when they passed.
He told their loved ones Marylanders will keep them in their hearts. He also thanked the state's healthcare heroes. The amusement park at the state's first mass vaccination site will reopen today. Six Flags America's Joseph Pudlick.
We're asking all guests to make a reservation in advance so that we can maintain proper social distance throughout the park.
They'll also be taking people's temperatures, requiring everyone to wear masks, and regularly sanitizing rides, restraints, and other surfaces that are touched a lot. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's no longer in charge of quarantines and other COVID restrictions. State legislators voted yesterday to take away his emergency powers and let local governments make decisions. His former aide and one of three women accusing him of sexual harassment, Charlotte Bennett, speaking out.
He is a textbook abuser. He lets his temper and his anger rule the office.
Bennett, in an interview with CBS This Morning about her allegations, and Cuomo's apologized for making people feel, quote, uncomfortable. If COVID has made you think about starting your own business, there's an event this weekend that can help.
The Franchise Expo is taking place at the Dulles Expo Center, and the event's Fred Cox says there will be seminars about how to start a business and the chance to meet with companies face-to-face.
They can come out and meet with over 50 different franchises that are looking for new owners right now in the Dulles, Virginia, D.C., and Maryland area, and learn all about the type of franchises that are available and which one might be perfect for them.
Tickets to the expo are $8. They can be purchased at virginiafranchiseshow.com. Maria Leaf on WMAL and WMAL.com.
WMAL Sports, the Caps lost to the Bruins 5-1. Spring training baseball, the Nats beat the Cardinals 7-6. Katie Ledecky led all the way in winning the 200-meter freestyle yesterday at the TYR Pro Swim Series meet, earning her third title in 3 days. Traffic and weather next. Here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
On 395 in the express lane southbound in Alexandria, there is road construction. Left lane is closed at King Street. In Merrifield, on the outer loop of the Beltway at 66, exit 49. While the right lane is blocked on the off-ramp from the outer loop to westbound 66. Only the left lane is getting by and the traffic is jammed back to the Dulles Toll Road. In Montgomery County, on the outer loop of the Beltway in Silver Spring, there is an accident between University Boulevard and Colesville Road. And in Silver Spring on George Avenue southbound, utility work is going on. Right lane is blocked at Bonnevin Street. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunshine battles winds from the northwest, which will pick up for another gusty day. Starting wind chills in the 20s will only feel like the 30s this afternoon. Actual high temperatures will reach the mid and upper 40s. We'll be back down to the 20s tonight. Tomorrow, you can expect highs in the mid 40s under more sunny skies and slightly calmer winds. We have a warming trend to look forward to next week with more spring-like temperatures. I'm ABC7 meteorologist Rachel Kay with the Stormwatch 7 weather team.
I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
Now, the Saturday morning update.
105.9 FM, WMAL.
It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. It is hour two. I'm Rick Fowler, and John Gizzi joins us. He is the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com and Newsmax TV. John, good morning.
Good morning, Rick. A pleasure.
You spent part of your Friday afternoon in the White House briefing room with the press secretary, Jen Psaki. You got several questions in. What did you ask of the press secretary, and what did you get as a response?
Well, I think the most important thing that came from this reporter was to wonder, when is the president going to deliver a State of the Union address? Joe Biden is already in the history books. He's gone the longest of any president in his first year without addressing a joint session of Congress on the State of the Union. The one exception to this was Richard Nixon in 1969, who didn't give any address at all in his first year. But every other address has been delivered in January or February so far. Jen Psaki said that the COVID-19 requirements for social distancing make this a very different kind of address to Congress, and they are working on the details. Once the details of seating are done, then Congress, as has been their custom, will invite the president to deliver the State of the Union, and he will acknowledge it. One other thing, I didn't ask, but others did, when is the president going to have a press conference? Jack Kennedy went before the public in a live press conference 5 days after he was sworn in 1961, and every president since then has held a news conference almost immediately after he was sworn into office. They are working on the details, and Jen said, a press conference is in the works for this coming month. We'll see about that. In the meantime, she's making the same claim that the Trump spokesman did at this point, that the president's answers as he boards Marine One, the helicopter, or when he's in his office and pool reporters get to throw a few questions at him, are sufficient. She said there's over 40 occasions when the president has been questioned, but still, there's nothing like a news conference, especially on national television.
So Mitch McConnell took some steps this week that has caused a lot of talk and a lot of speculation. What is it about?
It's about his succession when he decides to leave the Senate. Right now, the Democratic governor of Kentucky, Steve Beshear, can appoint whomever he wants if there's a vacancy in the Senate. The state legislature of Kentucky, over two-thirds of which is Republican, has moved to change the law, requiring governors to pick from a list of three from the executive committee of the party of the senator who is vacating the seat. In other words, if and when Mitch McConnell leaves, Republicans will offer the governor, Democrat or otherwise, three names from which he has to choose, the new senator from the bluegrass state. I might add that Mitch McConnell is already anticipating the passage of this. He's put out a list of three people he would like to see succeed him, the first on the list being State Attorney General Daniel Cameron, the first black to hold statewide office in Kentucky, and himself former legal counsel to Senator McConnell. Needless to say, all of this maneuvering has caused speculation that at age 79 and having a few health scares, Mitch McConnell may decide to leave the Senate. Most do not expect he'll do that soon, but as veteran political reporter Al Cross told me the other night, he's just doing what a smart politician would do when the Senate is split 50-50. He's taking out insurance.
The Democrats, of course, controlling the legislative agenda on Capitol Hill. And there is one bill, H.R. 1, that could really impact election security for decades to come. Tell us, number one, about the significance of it being number one. And number two, tell us about the bill.
Well, the significance of it being number one is that this is officially on the legislative agenda, the very first clash between Democrats and Republicans in a House that's the most closely divided since 1958 and a Senate that is 50-50 for each party with the vice president casting the tie-breaking vote. In other words, every party has to get every maneuver right in order to win, Republicans having to get just one or two from the other side to stop anything in the Senate. Now, H.R. 1 includes a greater federal hand in elections than has ever been felt in the history of elections. It essentially would take away power from the states, and it would federalize the election process. This means that laws in individual states on when voting can occur, when absentee ballots are applied, when mail can be used, would all be in the hands of the federales. Republicans, needless to say, want to trust secretaries of state as well as local town clerks, and they also believe that the possibility of fraud, which is usually generated when there's a lot of mail-in votes, is problematic. It passed the House of Representatives by a narrow margin. In all likelihood, it will die in the Senate because it needs 60 votes to break a filibuster against it. And, of course, the Democrats' 50 votes just won't mushroom up another 10.
John, it's been quite a week for the Dr. Seuss Library. The headline on one of your articles at Newsmax.com, Dr. Seuss was a liberal who championed civil rights. What are we missing in all of the mainstream coverage of Dr. Seuss?
Well, last week the Dr. Seuss Foundation, none of which includes any heirs to the man whose full name was Theodore Seuss Geisel, announced that it would no longer publish six of his early volumes. Now, these include, and to think I saw it on Mulberry Street, the very first book that he wrote in 1933, as well as five others. Many of those that we most identify with the beloved children's author, The Cat in the Hat, The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, or Horton Hears a Who, are not affected by this. By the way, Dr. Seuss is the biggest selling producer of a product, with the exception of Michael Jackson, whose works keep selling. Over 600 million books by Dr. Seuss have been sold. Now, the complaint offered by the Dr. Seuss Foundation is that there are caricatures and words in this which are offensive to certain people. I'll tell you what that is right away. In To Think It Started on Mulberry Street, there's a portrait of a native from Africa that one could construe as racist or stereotypical. There's another use of the word slant-eyed to describe someone from the Orient. And that brings us to Dr. Seuss himself. He was a Democrat. He was a fighting liberal who championed causes such as civil rights before they were popular. As cartoonist for the New York-based publication PM in the early 40s. In addition, desegregation of the armed forces became a cause célèbre of Dr. Seuss, and many black publications, such as The Defender or the Amsterdam News, noted he was their lone ally at the time. In later years, he continued the fight for civil rights, not exactly the trademark of a bigot. At one point, Dr. Seuss told a nephew, who told reporters last week, that he did realize that he followed the standards of the time in a few of his caricatures, and perhaps he might have gone too far as times and attitudes changed. He was someone who meant what he said and said what he meant and was faithful to his words 100%. Dr. Seuss.
John Gizzi, the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. Follow me on Twitter at John Gizzi. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Rick. And just let me know, in the House of Gizzi, March 4th was an historic date. My wife, in 1986, became the first woman to announce for the governorship of Michigan and then run a campaign. She didn't make it. But the man who beat her made her his lieutenant governor candidate. That's history made by someone who who's number one in my eyes and heart, Colleen House.
Wow, a pioneering woman in politics. That's cool. Thank you, John. It's 7:16. It's the Saturday Morning Update. Talk to Cheryl Atkinson next. But first, Albie Dees in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Here's your traffic update. First, in Montgomery County, on University Boulevard in Silver Spring, there is an accident, and it affects both directions before Piney Branch Road. Also in Silver Spring, on George Avenue southbound, there is utility work, and the right lane is blocked at Bonneville Street. In Alexandria, on 395, the express lane southbound, well, there's the left lane closed for construction at King Street. And in Falmouth, on 95 northbound, accident has the right lane blocked between 17 Warrington Road and the Centerport Parkway, exit 136. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Sunshine battles winds from the northwest, which will pick up for another gusty day. Starting wind chills in the 20s will only feel like the 30s this afternoon. Actual high temperatures will reach the mid and upper 40s. We'll be back down to the 20s tonight. Tomorrow you can expect highs in the mid 40s under more sunny skies and slightly calmer winds. We have a warming trend to look forward to next week with more spring-like temperatures. I'm ABC7 meteorologist Rachel Kay with the Stormwatch 7 weather team.
30 degrees in the nation's capital at 7:18.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
The Saturday Morning Update continues on WMAL. Rick Fowler with you, and good to have you along this morning. Cheryl Atkinson joins us. She is the host of Full Measure, of course. That's every Sunday at 10 o'clock on ABC 7. And she is the author of Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. Cheryl, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
President Biden has been erasing Trump policies on border security and managing immigration. Illegal border crossings are soaring. The Secretary of Homeland Security calls it a challenge. Critics call it a crisis. You are on site this week on the show. You've got the facts and the numbers. Give us a reality check.
We know this past week the Biden administration said there's no crisis at the border. But I go there at least once a year, sometimes twice a year, because I find a lot of people reporting on the border have never been there, just to see what the facts on the ground are. And every law enforcement person I spoke to this time says the crisis is already here. So a look at the hard numbers. There are 300,000 illegal immigrants in just the past 4 months who've been intercepted at the border. And at this pace, they say, this is going to surpass this year 2018, 2019, and 2020 combined, this huge surge. And the difference is, under Trump policies that really weren't well fleshed out and reported, in my view, under Trump policies, most of these people were sent back or to wait in Mexico or turned around at the border due to some steps he took in the 2018-2019 timeframe. Now, under President Biden, they'll be allowed to stay. So people in these border communities and law enforcement are expecting millions of people in the next couple of years, and it's starting now. And because Border Patrol told me they're not going to be caught again with no place to put people and then being criticized for the way they hold them and the places that they put the overflow, they're just going to release them. So they've notified these communities as far as 65 miles away from the southern border to expect that these illegal immigrants will be released in their towns. And by the way, Border Patrol says they will not be tested for coronavirus. So you can imagine, you know, the upset and the concern and the panic in places that, you know, some of these towns have 3,000 people who live there. You're talking about putting a huge flow of illegal immigrants into their system. They say they just can't handle it.
Well, one of the Trump policies was the Remain in Mexico policy. Tell us a little bit about the policy, and you spoke with a key Republican on that this week.
Well, yes, Senator Graham was in Arizona on the Mexican border right before I was, as it happens. And I interviewed him about Remain in Mexico because this was a key policy. Again, I didn't know much about it under President Trump. But what I found out is President Trump convinced Mexico to hold the people who would put one foot in the United States and claim asylum. And we were being overrun with people claiming asylum. He convinced Mexico to hold them in Mexico and await their court date. Well, what happened was it totally de-stressed our system, and people quit applying for asylum because it turns out Central Americans will not pay $20,000 to a human trafficker. This puts them in business, by the way, to wait in Mexico for 3 or 4 years. They want to wait in the United States. So that de-stressed our system that had been completely overloaded in the 2018 time period, causing all kinds of security and humanitarian crises. Well, now the Biden administration is lifting that. They're already transporting the ones left waiting in Mexico, more than 25,000, to the United States. And from now on, people who touch ground and say asylum, they get to stay here. And again, so in 4 months, if there's 300,000, but more on the way because word's getting out, it's going to be, it's expected to be a very, very huge flow. And Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection, everybody's bracing themselves.
I want to turn to an opinion piece that you've written at thehill.com. Congress in lockdown, will we just get used to it? And put it in perspective, because you've been covering Washington for a good portion of your career.
You know, when I first came to D.C. and didn't think much of it, but you could just walk right into the Capitol. I mean, you could, I could, any member of the public could. They didn't even have metal detectors, if I remember, because this was before 9/11. I'm talking about 1996 time period. And then, of course, the Islamic extremist terrorist attacks happened, and understandably, security tightened. And we all thought and speculated and talked about at the time, would this be permanent? Because it transformed the city from the concrete barriers around buildings to roads being shut off to the presence of the police in places they never used to be, you know, sort of stationed at roads, to the metal detectors and limiting who can go where and how. Well, you know, it's only gotten tighter since then. And I feel like in some respects, although it's understandable on the one hand, it's also become an excuse for public officials to distance themselves from the public and the press, who they work for and who's supposed to be able to oversee them. It's getting very hard to do. And when I was on the Hill this week and I saw these fences, even if you've seen Capitol Hill in the past few weeks, it was worse the other day when I was there, they tell me, than even before, because there was more of those conspiracy theories about another insurrection. These fences, they call it the perimeter now. I mean, I've been to third world countries and war-torn zones that don't look like this, you know, with concertina wire on top and barbed wire on these giant fences. Couldn't get anywhere close to the building I needed to get to for my interviews, you know, at least in a car. I mean, it's just wild. And it looks like they're prepared to fight an army from another country, you know, with all the security they have. And I kind of remarked to somebody up there on the Hill, you know, I wonder if, you know, this is going to dial back down again, or we're just going to stay tightened up like this, worse and worse. And the official said, it's like 9/11. We're just going to get used to it. So I'm afraid, you know, everything's really changed and changing in this country in ways maybe not everybody sees, because they don't visit Washington, D.C., or maybe don't know what it used to be like. But this is a really dramatic change.
Well, that's Cheryl's opinion piece again at thehill.com. Headline on it, Congress in lockdown. Will we just get used to it? Another story you have on Full Measure tomorrow, and I was kind of surprised, because we've heard so much about vaccines and coronavirus, but I've heard virtually nothing about the role of DNA in the fight against coronavirus and in the future of the fight against coronavirus. You've got a story on it. What do we learn?
You know, at Fort Detrick, the Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Diseases, they're doing all kinds of cool things to try to get to the bottom of this and other viruses. And it includes a lot of work at the DNA and genetic level. And they have lessons learned, by the way, from the Ebola pandemic. And I spoke to one of the researchers who was very modest and didn't tell me when I was interviewing him all the details about the role he played in West Africa working on Ebola. But it turns out he did some very key things there, looking at genetic markings or genetic ways to trace how Ebola was spreading. And for one example, using a machine, people didn't know, using a sort of a decoding machine, people didn't know at the time that Ebola was being sexually transmitted. I didn't know that till I did this interview. And they only found that out by doing a sophisticated analysis that he was able to, you know, think about and conduct and figure out, oh my goodness, you know, we can trace person to person in this case because Ebola spreads so fast. We can know exactly who gave it to who, which you can't do, I'm told, with coronavirus. You don't know who gave it to you. But with Ebola, they could tell, and they were able to conclude that men who tested negative for Ebola and had been released from the hospital were still ultimately spreading it through sexual contact. anyway, cool stuff, very interesting, and I'll have an interview with that gentleman Sunday on Full Measure.
And that is tomorrow morning, ABC 7, 10 o'clock, Full Measure. As always, Cheryl, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. We've got Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland coming up. Stay with us.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. Now, more than ever, depend on 105.9 FM WMAL, a Cumulus station. News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning, I'm Heather Curtis. It took 12 hours for Democratic Senate leaders to strike a deal with West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin on the unemployment benefits and the COVID relief bill. But that may pale in comparison to more debates. Republican Senator Bill Hagerty tells Fox News at night the GOP will use all procedural tactics available this weekend to slow down approval of the bill.
We go through the same number of amendments we did the last time we had one of these processes. It could take over 400 hours. If you use the benchmark of this latest amendment that they kept open for over 12 hours for one amendment.
Senate Republicans need Democrat defections to block or amend the legislation, which appears on course to pass the chamber this weekend. A vigil on the steps of the Maryland Statehouse yesterday to honor COVID-19 victims on the one-year anniversary of the state's first cases and the state of emergency. Governor Larry Hogan.
We resolve to never forget any of the 7,748 Marylanders who have been taken from us by this deadly virus.
Pope Francis making history with his visit to Iraq yesterday.
Pope Francis arrived in Baghdad, defying COVID and escalating violence in the region, becoming the first bishop of Rome to visit Iraq. Francis met with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi and also the Iraqi president.
Fox's Lauren Green. WMAL Sports, the Caps lose to the Bruins. Traffic and weather next. Here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
Now I have a traffic update first in D.C. There is a disabled vehicle on 295, the Anacostia Freeway, southbound at East Capitol Street. Don't have any reports of any slowdowns yet. In Alexandria, road construction left lane is closed on the express lanes of 395 southbound at King Street. In Silver Spring, there is an accident on University Boulevard. It affects both directions before Piney Branch Road. And in Silver Spring, utility work is going on. Right lane is blocked on Georgia Avenue, southbound at Bonneville Street. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Dry, cool, and breezy. That's our trend, and it continues today with below normal temperatures. A chilly start will warm to highs in the mid and upper 40s, but wind chills will stay in the 30s even at the peak of the afternoon. Wind gusts around 25 miles per hour will make you want to bundle up despite the sun. Lows tonight fall to the 20s again, mostly sunny Sunday with a lighter breeze and highs in the mid 40s. I'm ABC 7 meteorologist Rachel Kay with the Stormwatch 7 weather team.
I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
The Saturday morning update continues. It's 7:37. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the author of Operation Dark Heart. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research and hosts the Thought to Action podcast. It's good to have you with us, Tony.
Hey, always great to join you, Rick. Good morning.
All right. Depending on who you talk to, you get a completely different picture of what's going on at the southern border. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, says that it's a challenge. If you talk to Republicans or you talk to people in Texas, including Democratic legislators in Texas, they say it's a crisis. Which is it?
It's a crisis, and I think it's very apparent by what we've seen in the media if you pay attention. I mean, Rick, they've gone back to allowing for 100% capacity in these child detention facilities because of the broad range and number of folks coming across the border. There's a couple of different reasons for this. First, the Biden administration has gone about dismantling the very effective and working program that the Trump administration has established to essentially create in-country, south of the border, locations for amnesty for people seeking it, to have them held there. And it was working very well. Department of Defense was able to get ahead of it and work with a lot of our regional allies. And now that that's being dismantled, there's a surge, literally, of people to the border, which has overwhelmed rapidly Homeland Security's ability, ICE security, and Homeland, you know, the Border Patrol security to ability to stop it. So that's what we're seeing. And again, the people in Texas are nonpartisan people complaining. This is not a left or right issue. This is an issue of security. And the fact is, the Biden administration's doing with the border what the Cuomo administration did with the number of deaths in nursing homes. It's very bad.
Now, a little bit on the people who are coming across the border. The emphasis has been on the children, the unaccompanied minors. But who else is coming across the border?
Everybody. And that's one of the issues. One of the things that we don't know is how many of these children, even if they make it to the border, are essentially here because of coyotes or human traffickers. And then obviously we have the added issue of national security. We don't actually know anything about adults coming across either. And let me say the obvious. If you've been telling people you need to lock down for COVID and restrict travel and individuals who have to social distance and hold out, you know, go to some place and hang out for 14 days, Rick, I'm pretty sure people coming across the border illegally are not going to self-quarantine 14 days to make sure they don't have COVID. So the fact that they've opened this up and left it completely open tells me everything about the Biden administration's inability to focus on proper policy and execute it. So that's what's going on. And I think, again, people have to recognize this policy is dangerous not only to individuals, the unaccompanied minors who may be abused. It's dangerous to the idea of leaving the border open and allowing anybody to come across. Even if they're not terrorists, you come across with diseases and other things which cannot be controlled.
All right. Help me understand the logic behind the Biden administration saying that they will welcome immigrants, but don't come now. Don't come now, but wait. Okay. Hold off a little bit, but we're going to welcome you, but don't come now.
Well, that's frankly, they're not listening.
And of course
what
not.
What they're trying to say is, well, you know, we're going to set up this entire complex scheme of allowing those in the country now to be on a path to citizenship. By the way, it's supposed to be like after this administration ends. That's when that path would end. And then also the idea is they're going to create a program of essentially day workers or some sort of a system which allows people to cross the border during, you know, whatever. It's all pie in the sky. There's not bipartisan support. It's just more of a Biden administration trying to put things out there to be judged by its intent, not by what it's going to actually achieve. So,
all right, I want to turn to the U.S. Capitol. There was anticipation of another attack at the Capitol on March 4th. What was behind the QAnon threat?
So, yeah, let me be very clear for the audience on this. From everything I've seen, there was no specific threat. There was, you know, a lot of the time being an intelligence officer, you get, you know, there's going to be an event at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk on this day. Be aware. None of that came in. The assessment that was the basis for the alert is an assessment. The FBI and DHS got together and they came up with what they believe what could happen based on quote unquote chatter. So obviously the chatter was wrong. And I think a lot of this was driven by the mainstream media, by CNN and MSNBC, who are literally promoting Q and QAnon, and feeding fuel to the fire. And I can't help believe that some analyst over DHS watched that and said, oh boy, we better pay attention, because that's all that seemed to happen. Rick, this is dangerous because there are real threats out there. There are real things that could happen. And the more you get this over-reliance on, I would say, almost an emotional response to Q, the less you're looking for real threat issues. And so the 4th of March issue, I think, is a perfect example of where you need to really take a step back and assess what the real threat is before you start putting out analysis which essentially forecasts something that doesn't happen.
One of the people we miss most from the Trump administration is Rick Grenell, the former director of National Intelligence. And I know you have him on the podcast, and I just wanted to mention that again because he is so spot on when he analyzes these issues of the day.
So, yeah, so Rick is on the Thought to Action, the Lena Center Thought to Action podcast this week. We go through several issues, one of them which I'm literally already working this morning, answering email on, is the Abraham Accords. One of the things that the London Center wants to facilitate, and many in the Middle East, other countries want to facilitate, is the continuation of the expansion of the peace agreements that the Trump administration did. Rick Grenell obviously was intimately involved in that. Rick and I talk about the future of the Abraham Accords and what needs to be done next, and I think obviously, the audience that tunes in to us here on Saturdays will obviously enjoy our content and my discussions with Rick.
And that can be found at londoncenter.org, correct?
That's correct. Yes, sir.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, thank you as always, sir.
Thank you, Rick.
You bet. 7:45 Saturday morning update. KT McFarland coming up next, but first, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In D.C. on 295, the Anacostia Freeway southbound, disabled vehicle at East Capitol Street. I do not have any reports of a slowdown through that area. In Silver Spring on Georgia Avenue southbound, utility work is going on. Right lane is blocked to Bonneville Street. In Alexandria on 395, the express lane southbound, road construction. Left lane is closed at King Street. And in Fairfax on Eaton Place eastbound, right lane is closed between Chambridge Road and Route 50. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Sunshine battles winds from the northwest, which will pick up for another gusty day. Starting wind chills in the 20s will only feel like the 30s this afternoon. Actual high temperatures will reach the mid and upper 40s. We'll be back down to the 20s tonight. Tomorrow, you can expect highs in the mid-40s under more sunny skies and slightly calmer winds. We have a warming trend to look forward to next week with more spring-like temperatures. I'm ABC7 meteorologist Rachel Kay with the Stormwatch 7 weather team.
Holding steady at 30 degrees, 7:46 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL. 7:50, it's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us. And we welcome KT McFarland. She is President Trump's first deputy national security advisor. She has authored Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, it is an honor to have you with us this morning.
Well, it's an honor and a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I wanted to go start the meeting with the old business first, and then we'll get to the new business. And just a quick recap on CPAC, because it segues into the current topic of the day. You know, when we talked last week, the former president had not yet spoken at CPAC. So contrast how CPAC kind of started out and how it ended.
Well, it started out, so I was there at the very beginning, and it started out, you know, there was a lot of tentativeness. There was, as you talk to people in the corridors and the restaurants and in the various early meetings, it was a lot of, oh, where do we go from here? What's next? And yet it started building, and you realize that in fact, the conservative movement is not just still around and still, it's not on life support. It's actually at a moment of great innovation and creativity. So there were a lot of panels that were about substantive issues on tax reform, voter integrity, foreign policy, and those over-attended. I mean, people were standing in the halls trying to get into those meetings. And then it was an opportunity to see a lot of the future leaders of the party and then culminating with President Trump himself. I mean, the way I looked at it and in my presentations, what I said was I was in the White House the night Richard Nixon was forced out of office. It was during Watergate, and I remember being at just the lowest point thinking, oh, the Republican Party is finished. It's never going to come back. My career is finished. It's all over. And yet within 6 years, we were back in the White House with Ronald Reagan. Now, why did that happen? Part of it was because Jimmy Carter, and I think Joe Biden is Jimmy Carter 2.0. I mean, Jimmy Carter was elected to heal the nation, bring the country out of the despondency of the crisis of Watergate. And yet, within a few short years, he had cratered the economy so that we had very high inflation. I mean, 20% inflation and very high unemployment and a stagnant economy. And in foreign policy, we're being pushed around all over the world, but particularly by the Soviet Union and by Iran. I think the same thing's going to happen. It's not going to take too long. The Biden administration is going to have a very terrible economy within 2 years. Gasoline prices are going to go through the roof. I mean, $6, $8, $10 a gallon, sure, why not? Energy prices are going to go up, taxes are going to go through the roof, and the economy is going to stagnate. And at the same time, we'll be pushed around all over the world, again, by Iran, but this time by China. So I think there's a realization that this is a moment of recreating the Republican Party, looking for a new generation of leaders across the board. And so it ended actually on quite a high note.
All right. The reason I wanted to talk about that first is because the energy that you are seeing coming out in the conservative movement will need to immediately be applied to the fight against H.R. 1, and that is the legislation in the House that, according to Senator Paul Sarbanes' website, expands access to the ballot box by taking aim at institutional barriers to voting, including cumbersome voter registration systems, disenfranchisement, and limited voting hours. It will create automatic voter registration across the country, ensure that individuals who have completed felony sentences have their full voting rights restored, expand early voting, and enhance absentee voting, simplify voting by mail. I could go on. What's wrong with that picture, KT?
You know, I think this could well be the biggest voter, the biggest fraud and power grab on American history since Aaron Burr. And when he talks about expanding, you know, the voter, of course, it means everybody's going to get a vote a couple of times. Why not? What this bill does is two things that I find chilling. One, it bans the state and local governments from cleaning out their voter lists. You know, most people think if I register to vote because I've just moved, all the other registrations I ever had in the past, previous addresses, college addresses, that they disappear. No, they don't. They stay on. It's ripe for abuse and voter fraud. The other thing it does is it really prevents, well, it doesn't prevent the stoppage of the censor culture. It kind of embodies, it codifies the censor culture, the cancel culture, the censorship of the media. So, you know, if these people were honest with themselves, which of course they're not because it's all about power, right? They'd realize that what they're doing is putting America on a course of disenfranchisement, really discrediting elections to the point that they're not going to mean much anymore. But maybe that's their goal. Maybe they love power so much more than anything else that they're deluding themselves about what this bill really means. Maybe they love power so much that they think they're going to be in power forever. You know, the whole Russia hoax and the entire Trump administration, all of the excesses that were committed, the lying, the newspapers and the media getting so biased against Trump, it was all done under the excuse of, well, Donald Trump's so bad the rules don't apply anymore. We're not no longer going to be an unbiased source. We're now going to all take sides. And yet now Donald Trump is gone, and they're still doing it. They're doing it even more. So you realize that the Donald Trump thing, that was really just an excuse they made for the power grab. Mm-hmm. I mean, shame on them all, is my opinion.
Speaking of the power grab, it's been going on all night in the Senate as they're positioned to pass the $1.9 trillion budget buster COVID relief package. It's filled with pork, and I've got 2 minutes with you, KT. Your thoughts on the COVID relief package?
Where do they think the money's coming from? Who do they think they're borrowing the money from? Who's our largest foreign debt holder? China. China's thrilled at the fact that we're trillions of dollars in debt because it gives them such leverage over us. They could sell off all the debt in a minute. We can't pay it back. Think about it this way. You've got a mortgage on your house that you can't possibly pay back. You're having trouble meeting the monthly mortgage payment. And the bank suddenly decides, because it has the right, the bank suddenly decides, I want all my money by noon tomorrow. And you say, well, I can't. So what do you have to do? You forfeit the house. That's the position that China and other debt holders, but really China, because they're the ones that have made it pretty clear in the past that they'll use anything they can to hurt the United States, to not militarily. They don't want a military war. They just want to defeat us economically, technologically, diplomatically and culturally and in every other way. So, again, I think that it's just the height of irresponsibility by Biden and Pelosi and Schumer, and I think history will not treat them well. The other thing, by the way, to go back to CPAC, we're within inches of having Republicans take the House and the Senate in 2022. And how are the Democrats going to like it when the tables are turned, when the power then is put into the hands of the Republicans? I think that they're taking us in a place where the nation should never go. But again, it's all about power. It's all about their personal power, keeping themselves in power at any cost and at any price.
KT McFarland, the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. As always, KT, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Our pleasure. That's it for the Saturday morning update. Garden Sense follows the 8 o'clock news here on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. Now, more than ever, depend on 105.9 FM WMAL, a Cumulus station.